Your Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division, hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. Now your host, Dick Bertel.
Good afternoon. And with me once again is radio historian collector Ed Corcoran. Our guest is an author today, Ed.
Not only an author, Dick, but an author of one of the finest books I've ever seen on this subject. It's called The Golden Years of Broadcasting, and it's really a gem, and I think every fan should have one of these. I'd like to introduce you to the author, Robert Campbell.
Bob, it's good to have you with us. This is a celebration of the first 50 years of radio and TV on NBC, and this book, as I understand it, was authorized by NBC.
Yes, it was their birthday book.
It was. How did you become involved?
Well, I was asked, I was invited by Rutledge Books to write the book, mm-hmm. and their essential thing is handsome books. That's what they do. And I'm happy to say I did it well enough. It was originally for NBC. I did it well enough, and that Scribner's took it over and made it into a trade book. It was written for the public, and so that's where it's gone public.
Well, I understand that at first you thought this was going to be a breeze. In essence, you were going to go down and go through the files and interview people, and you'd have your background, and you'd be all set.
You better say at first, I didn't think.
Oh, really?
That's right, yeah. At first, I didn't think. That's what I thought would... But there was no way in the world that would possibly work. Mm-hmm. It's an enormous place. There are all kinds of departments and people and things and stuff. So I must have spent, you know, 4, 5, 6 months... just poking around, talking to people, looking at things, and trying to figure out what in the world in this enormous place would interest the public. Sports fans, or soap opera fans, or movie fans, or drama fans, or news fans. It's like trying to do 12 stories.
Sure, sure.
And getting a handle on each one.
And how did you begin to narrow in and focus in?
Well, I would tell people, I want to talk to you, but I don't know what about. I'm fishing, you know. When I've caught something, I'll let you know. That just kind of went that way month after month.
How many people did you interview? Do you have any idea?
Oh, must have been 75, 100.
And by this time, many of them, I assume, were probably scattered, were they? No longer with NBC? Some
well, there were some. I found some retired people. I found one of the early heads of television programming who's living in Hawaii. We had several long conversations on mm-hmm. the phone.
Mm-hmm.
I found an old retired staff photographer who took a lot of the historical pictures. We had spent an hour on the phone talking about the sound man, because there was this one nice picture about how sound effects, you know, the squeaking door,
sure.
the clanking chain and all that. We must have spent and the pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
The squashed head. We must have spent an hour talking about how all that magic in radio happened, you know.
Well, you know, when you talk in terms of NBC, General Sarnoff comes to mind, obviously. He's the whole idea, the whole concept, the whole breath behind NBC. And I understand you uncovered some rather interesting things concerning him.
Well, there was... An earlier NBC RCA kind of in-house history written. It was never really published. And there's a line in it about Sarnoff and the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what made him famous in a way. This would be 1912, April 15th. he was a baby wireless operator in the Wanamaker store. He was about 21 at that time, and all the official story said was Sarnoff was there around midnight. That would be April 14th, going into the 15th. And he picked up this message, SS Titanic ran into iceberg, sinking fast. And then he stayed there for 72 hours, accumulating the names of the survivors. And there was something about the story that seemed too bald. Why did he stay there for 72 hours? The boat went down about 4, mm-hmm. you know. And did the message say, SS Titanic ran into iceberg? It seems a little pat, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a letter to Walter Lord, who wrote A Night to Remember and has got to know more about the Titanic than anybody, and said, something about this story I don't understand. It seems too skimpy. Well, anyway, Walter Lord called me up, and we had several long conversations. Turned out probably Sarnoff was never in touch with the Titanic, which was 1,000 miles out in the ocean. It only had a wireless range of about 500 miles, although at night it could jump, you know, and it was at night. But it was mostly relayed by Cape Race and on down. And the Carpathia had picked up the survivors. And the reason for the 72 hours was that the names were all tapped out in Morse code, letter by letter.
Oh.
And given fade out and static and all that. It literally took 3 days and three nights to send the list of 705 people. And according to Walter Lord, it was remarkably accurate.
Oh, that does say quite a bit for him.
And anyway, that made wireless, you know. It was all of a sudden realized how important that was. It made Sarnoff's name, and shortly thereafter it made radio.
Well, could you tell us a little more, you know, talking about General Sarnoff, about the formation of the network itself? This was the first bold step toward what we know today as NBC, but what was the origins like? Where did the money come from and the ideas, and how was it all put together?
Well, it was really Sarnoff's idea. Sarnoff figured out that if you could make a radio network, there are all these individual stations, you know, like KDKA, WEAF, WJZ, and WGN.
And WTIC.
And WTIC. But the individual station, in most cases, couldn't really put on expensive programming or entertainment within a station's budget. And Sarnoff conceived the notion, which is, I think, very clever. You could put them all together, or a bunch of them together, and supply them all with entertainment, news, or whatever. That made sense. So it was his brainchild, really, and he put it all together in 1926.
What was their concept of radio broadcasting when the network was formed? In other words, what did they offer in the way of programming?
Well, Sarnoff had said, this will be necessary to entertain a nation, to quote him. And he even had the idea of having two channels very early on so that people would have a selection.
Which was the red
became,
and the blue.
Became then the red and the blue network, of course. Mm-hmm. One was class and the other was cash.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And you could have either. I think the original broadcast, you know, all the big bands and orchestras and comics and singers, I think it was probably kind of clear there from the start what kind of a medium it could be. And then, of course, it had all of vaudeville to pull on. You know, Fred Allen, Jack Benny, and all those people were natural for radio.
And did they move into radio with great rapidity, or
yes.
Were they reluctant?
No, they came over, really, within the next few years, everybody defected to radio.
Mm-hmm.
Practically Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, practically everybody. All the big names of vaudeville were in radio within a few years.
Well, radio did kind of form or reach its early peak during the Depression years.
Sure.
And if you owned the radio, all you had to pay for was electricity. If you went to vaudeville or any other entertainment, you had to pay. So this probably had an effect, don't you think, the fact that it was a free entertainment and people were short of money at this time.
Sure, and you had to go to the city if you wanted to go to vaudeville, unless the carnival came to town.
Sure. Well, why don't we turn back the clock and listen to one of those early programs.
Well, how about a vaudevillian, Dick, by the name of Jimmy Durante, and we'll see how he sounded on NBC.
Okay.
As you know, ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy Durante has invited Lucille Ball to his house for dinner to discuss her new picture, in which Durante plans to play the part of her lover. Her lover. Silly, isn't it? As we look in on him now, he is making frenzied preparations for her arrival, aided and abetted, of course, by Treacher.
Treacher, let's get ready for our guest. This joint needs organizing. Don't you think this house needs a thorough cleaning?
Cleaning is hardly the word. While dusting this morning, I discovered another room.
How nice. I'll convert it into a nursery. My police dog is expecting rookies. But this is no time for trivialities, Treacher. Miss Ball.
Oh, come on, boy, come on.
Let me go back to that,
I will,
please.
Like to...
I think I can do a little better.
Right.
But this is no time for trivialities, Treacher.
No.
Miss Ball will be here any minute. Lay out my dinner jacket, my cutaway vest, and reverse my celluloid collar.
Yes, sir.
And, Treacher, when you serve dinner tonight, I want you to look sartorially correct. I'm expecting you will wear a dress shirt.
But I'm sorry, sir, but you're wearing it tonight. However, don't concern yourself. I can always whitewash my chest.
Whitewash your chest? What will you do for shirt studs?
Well, I happen to have three very convenient moles.
Treacher, you're a genius. Remind me to reward you with a soggy Tootsie Roll.
How provincial. May I ask, what is the purpose of Miss Ball's visit here tonight?
Since I have the next line, I'll answer that question. Miss Ball wants us to discuss her scenario. She's looking for a handsome and talented leading man.
Oh, how nice of you to have thought of me.
Wait a minute. What makes you think Lucille Ball would prefer you to me?
Well, can I help it if I'm the sophisticated type? Women like a man who has lived.
I've lived?
I mean recently. Besides, you know, to intrigue a woman of Miss Ball's caliber, one must not only be handsome and talented, but also well-dressed, suave, and debonair.
Well, I'm well-dressed, suave, and debonair, ain't I?
Ho, ho, ho! You have had your answer.
Boy, that's gratitude for you, folks. And to think I let the hem down on all my nightgowns so they would fit him. But, Treacher...
Right, what do you want for dinner?
What's this?
It's a cook I hired for the occasion.
For a minute, I thought it was Sadie Hawkins Day and somebody sent us a hawk.
Never mind the smart cracks, hose nose. How do you want your dinner, boiled or fried?
What have you got for dinner?
Nothing.
Burl it. Teacher, I guess we'll be here any minute, and you mean to say there's nothing for dinner? What about that plum duff we had yesterday? Isn't there any left?
No, but I could serve some plain duff.
What's plain duff?
Plain duff is plum duff after you've taken the plum out of the duff and all that's left is the stuff.
Put blues on the end of that and you got a hit song. That must be Lucille Ball now. Quick, Preacher, where's my perfume? Yeah, that's it. Now squirt some on my hair, in my eyebrows, behind my ears, under my nose. That's it. I've laid a perfect trail to my lips. Open the door, Treacher. Wait till Lucille Ball gets a whiff to this.
Is somebody cooking cabbage?
Lucille Ball!
In person.
I'm overwhelmed, Lucille. The exuberance of this unctuous occasion... and the mere quintessence of your celestial radiance premeditates my bountiful soul with palpitation of grandiosius jocanunitigi.
Jimmy, if you think that over, I'm sure you'll take it back.
Take it back? Nothing. I had a hard enough time getting rid of it.
Well, don't let me excite you, Jimmy. I'm just like any other blonde.
What do you mean, blonde? Your hair is red.
Red? Please, Jimmy, in Hollywood, we don't say that word.
But step inside the rotunda, Lucille. You've never seen my house before.
Oh, I think it's terrific, Jimmy. And you've already decorated for Halloween. Oh, I love that pumpkin head in the corner with a silly grin.
Please, that's my Uncle Louie looking at the pictures in Esquire.
Well, Jimmy, as long as we're comfortable here, maybe we can start talking about the picture we're going to make together.
Marvelous. Why don't we do something like your last picture, Her Husband's Affairs? I can just see myself in one of those political pictures. Being elected president and moving into the White House in Los Angeles.
Oh, Jimmy, the White House is 2,000 miles away. You don't know federal law.
You don't know the Los Angeles city limits. This town is so spread out, Beverly Hills is now a town in Iowa.
Jimmy, I'd like to do a part in a picture that's a little different. You know, a character part.
Ah, Lucille, that's what I like about you. You're so versatile.
No, thank you, James. It's people like you that make people like me realize that we should carry the art of Sarah Bernhardt to all the people of the universe and to people wherever there are people.
Folks, you have just heard We the People. Listen, don't tell me you're from Brooklyn.
Of course not, stupid. I'm from the Bronx. And they loved me there. Yeah, when the fella saw me in her husband's affairs with Francho Tone, they awarded me a very great honor.
A great honor?
Yes. They voted me Miss Other End of the Davenport for 1947. And, Jimmy, you know, my family was very refined. I come from a long line of Murphys, Kellys, and O'Toole's. But my mother married a Mulligan.
But Mulligan is an Irish stew.
Well, she knew that, but she married him anyway.
Ah, Lucille, you really got it on the ball.
I say hello. May I join you?
Everybody wants to get into the act.
How are you, Mr. Treacher?
Splendid, Miss Ball. By the way, have you seen our library yet?
Oh, yes, and I'm dying to read The Fall and Decline of the Grecian Satellites. By Golinio Roble.
I read
Miss
a lot.
Miss Ball, my favorites are Aristotle's Soliloquies and Spinoza's Spheric Dialectics.
I spent the time in
the best I ever read were The Anatomy of Melancholia and Anecdotes of an Antiquated Octogenarian.
Did anyone see what Dick Tracy did to Mumbles today?
Jimmy Durante, as he sounded, well, probably 40 years ago anyway, on NBC Radio.
Before he had his nose job done.
Our guest tonight is Robert Campbell. He is the author of The Golden Years of Broadcasting, a celebration of the first 50 years of radio and TV on NBC. And we'll get back to that story in a moment.
Your late payment worries are over. With their new pre-authorized payment plan, Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division will automatically deduct the amount of your loan or mortgage payment from your personal checking account. You won't need to worry about getting the payments in on time ever again. They'll take care of it for you, fast and efficiently, by automatically deducting the amount of your loan or mortgage from your personal checking account. Stop in at any of the 6 conveniently located offices to arrange for your automatic loan and mortgage payment deductions. There are 2 Farmers and Mechanics Savings Banks in Middletown, 1 in Montville and Colchester, and Cromwell Savings Bank, Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, at the corner of Main and West Streets, and at the Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. All 5 branch offices are now open Saturdays, 9 to noon, for your convenience. Members, FDIC. Once again, Dick Bertel.
Bob Campbell is our guest. We're talking about his new book, The Golden Years of Broadcasting, and I understand that Bob Hope contributed a portion to your book.
Yes. I managed to find him in Burbank one day. He was taping, and talking to him was wonderful. I almost finished the book at that time. And a weird thing happened. He was taping a big show in Burbank, and his press agent and I got together somehow by accident, the way so many things happen. Thought, well, gee, wouldn't it be neat to do a sidebar piece on Bob Hope, an interview for the comedy section, maybe. He's been NBC from the beginning, you know, unlike anybody else. Seemed like a real natural, and I was supposed to go do this on a Saturday because Hope was doing a Texaco commercial. So he was supposed to be just standing around a gas pump. There'd be plenty of time, you know. Naturally, it was a weather day.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, I'll stay over the weekend. Then I finally went out and didn't get him until the following Monday. And a weird thing, I woke up that morning, and the theme music from Amos and Andy was running through my head. I hadn't heard it since I was a kid. You know, the perfect song.
Sure.
I had never thought of it, but for some weird reason, there it was. And I went to see Bob Hope, and I said, "Do you remember this tune?" You know. And, of course, I had some questions I wanted to ask him. And he was marvelous. I'd kind of ask him a question, say about Amos and Andy or something, you know. And he'd kind of hunt like a radar set and talk kind of slowly and quietly, like he was trying to get a fix on something.
Yeah. Know?
And then all of a sudden he'd pop up, and he was Bob, pure Bob Hope. And he would really tell, he told about how the whole country shut down when Amos and Andy came on, you know, and remembered all of that. And then he'd sort of fade out. And then I'd ask him another question, and he'd start hunting again and talking slowly. Then up he'd come, and here would be a story. So it turned out good enough that it became the foreword to the book.
Well, it's quite a foreword, and it's quite a book, too. The stories that you have in here are rather unusual in many respects, because they're things that haven't been told before. And some of the photographs, looking through them, Ed, I think are just absolutely marvelous. I love these wireless communication signs and so on.
Yes, and the color photographs are really done just as beautiful as you can expect. They're just marvelous. And it does cover television, by the way, and even some shows that are just been put on the air this year. So it's a very up-to-date book as far as photographs covering the whole era from 1920 right through 1976.
Who was the big influence, do you feel, as far as programming is concerned at NBC during those formative years? Was it Sarnoff?
I think it was Sarnoff. I think it was very much a family affair. I think Sarnoff had a kind of European cultural background, and I think that explains a lot of the fine music that was on radio, including Toscanini and the NBC Symphony. Of course, I think NBC saved America from musical malnutrition.
For a while.
Yeah, for a while. Because, you know, what did you have around the house? Old Gallicherchi records, you know, and on the old wind-up Victrola. That was about all there was. And when you could listen to the Toscanini and the NBC Symphony, that was something else.
Did you get to learn much about the building, the concept of Radio City, the construction of it, and so on?
Well, I never really got into it physically so much, other than the RCA building was certainly built with NBC in mind as the prime tenant.
Mm-hmm.
And Studio 8H, which is the massive studio, it's at Lecture Night, you know, now on television, but it was originally Toscanini's studio, was built, and it's literally suspended in the middle of the RCA building. It's not part of the building, but it's hung on cables, I presume, because to keep the subway from vibrating it. I don't.
Yeah, it is a soundproofing system. They call it the floating studio, I believe.
But that's as far. It was also very elegant, you know, a very formal building in terms of layout and staff, you know, and people. I'm sure the NBC Symphony performed in tails, even though it was all just on the radio, you know.
Did you find that many people who were presently with NBC were in a position to help you with these early years?
Oh, sure. And I felt obliged to follow all kinds of hunches because I didn't know where they would lead. The vice president of children's programming, George Heidemann, from Chicago. He said to me just sort of casually one day, "You ought to talk to Charlie Andrews. He really knows about Chicago." I said, "Well, who's Charlie Andrews?" And then he disappeared, and I never saw him again. So I had lunch with Charlie Andrews. It turned out Charlie Andrews was the writer of the old Garraway at Large show.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that, I kind of found out about the Chicago school of television and kind of where the whole Today show came from, Studs Place and all those shows.
So there was a great Chicago influence in broadcasting.
Sure.
Well, Dick, how about a historic broadcast? Maybe I didn't think about this until we started talking, but I have a show where they opened the NBC studios in Hollywood, you know, a very memorable time, and I have an actual excerpt from that particular broadcast. So that was a very big occasion for NBC, so why don't we listen and see how it sounded at that time.
Hollywood is vibrantly ablaze tonight with its first big radio premiere. For years, Hollywood has been noted for its glamorous first night. Surely this dedication tonight of the opening of the new and greater NBC Hollywood will be written creditably among the pages of important Hollywood history. To lend their goodwill in helping to dedicate the new NBC Hollywood, thousands have come to visit these studios tonight. Thousands more will pass through its portals in the days and years to come. Here in this beautiful auditorium studio and on this large stage are gathered the nation's favorite names of radio, screen, and stage. Other famous entertainers join us later during the program from Baltimore, New York, Chicago, even from London, England, and from Honolulu, Hawaii. Most certainly, this is a gala event, a Hollywood premiere that will not soon be forgotten. In the minds and hearts of many noted persons tonight, it may mean more than the commemoration of a new building of broadcasting studios. It may mean to them a monument to radio and to Hollywood. Perhaps that is the real meaning of the new sign that so brilliantly shoots its light toward western skies tonight. A sign that reads, NBC Hollywood. Our dedicatory program opens with that master showman who has more than once lent his very life's blood and ingenuity to sustain, vitalize, and even help create a new and more substantial industry. Not because the true import of his name demands that we be gentle with superlatives, but because he himself is such a swell guy, we know he would become sincerely embarrassed at our words. So may we merely present him as the world's greatest entertainer, Al Jolson.
Thank you, Ken Carpenter. Those are very sweet words, and believe me, I'm grateful. Hey, I'm grateful to anybody that says nice things about me. And all you folks listening in, good evening. And at this time, I want to tell you, you're in for one of the greatest evening's entertainments you've ever listened to on the radio. But before I say anything about the show, well, honestly, I don't know how to begin. These studios are so beautiful, my hat is off to everyone connected with a national broadcasting company, especially to my good friend, Deke Ellsworth, the president of NBC. He is my friend, and I have every reason to believe he will remain my friend. I never asked him for a job, and he's never offered me one. Deke Ellsworth, what a man. I don't know how in the world one man can accomplish so many things. Get this. He's president of the National Broadcasting Company. He runs RKO and Radio City, too, and still he finds time to be nice and sweet to even the elevator boys in the building. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a man. And still, Mr. Ellsworth, I don't need a job. But, ladies and gentlemen, I've got to tell you about these new studios. I only wish I had enough adjectives and superlatives at my command to explain how really beautiful they are. Well, the moment I got here tonight, two footmen in gold braid uniforms came running out to my car. At first, I thought it was a finance company. Well, they helped me out of the car. They led me up to a great, big, polished marble entranceway, and a couple of other guys in uniforms helped me get inside the door. And mind you, they kept helping me, lift me up. And I hadn't had a drink all day. And what do you think? There was a line of page boys in pretty blue uniforms. They showed me all over the place. Big, beautiful auditorium studios. And what dressing rooms for the artists. Showers and everything. Right away, I took a bath. No, I'll waste water at my house. Well, I could go on like this all night, but I'm not going to. I'm going to get this show underway. And just to give you an idea what a terrific show we're going to have tonight, who do you think I'm going to call on first? Don Wilson, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you, Al. Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Here with us tonight in these new NBC Hollywood studios is a man whom America has loved for many years for his simple and homely philosophies in poetry. You've read his books, you've read his newspaper column of poems, and you've heard him on the air often. Soon you are to see and hear this famous fireside philosopher in a motion picture entitled You Can't Lose, which he is making now at the Universal Studios here in Hollywood. Of course, I mean Edgar Guest.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm most happy to appear for a few minutes upon this dedication program and to congratulate the National Broadcasting Company, its friendly staff at Hollywood and Tyre upon the achievement of this new and serviceable building. I've never grown used to radio. I still don't believe it. I know that what I'm now saying may be heard around the nation in high place and low, in the library, at the hospital bed, by the rich, by the poor. But how it's done still baffles me. Heard you last night wireless to friends from a ship in the Pacific Ocean last winter. I believe he must have done so, but it still seems incredible. On the evening referred to, I did speak at a microphone in Chicago. But that my voice should be heard on a ship at sea was, and still is, beyond my powers of imagination. This evening, as I stand in this studio, the marvel of it all is to me that by this magic of men and machinery, the artists who appear here are given the world for an audience. Up to very recent years, the great singers and the great talkers, the rulers and the princes, the statesmen and the champions in all lines of human endeavor were the privilege of only the very few. Only those heard Patty who could get within range of her voice. Only those heard the Gettysburg Address who could crowd around the beloved Lincoln as he spoke. Today, because of this thing called radio, men and women everywhere are ear witnesses to the world's great events.
The opening of the NBC studios in Hollywood back in the 1930s from Ed Corcoran's fabulous collection.
They tore it down, Dick, by the way, that same studio, unfortunately.
Well, that perhaps is indicative of where the golden years of broadcasting actually went, right, as far as radio programs is concerned anyway. We'll be back to our guest, Robert Campbell, the author of The Golden Years of Broadcasting, right after this.
You won't have to worry about overdrafts and bouncing checks with the new 24-hour telephone transfer service at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Now you can transfer funds 24 hours a day from your interest-earning statement savings account to your personal checking account, or vice versa, at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division just by calling their new telephone transfer service. It's fast and convenient, saves you time and worry over unnecessary overdrafts. Stop by either Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank in Middletown or in Montville or Colchester, or the Cromwell Savings Bank, division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, at the corner of Main and West Street, and at the Cromwell Plaza office near Kmart. All five branch offices are now open Saturdays, 9 to noon, for your convenience. Members, FDIC. Once again, back to Dick Bertel.
Our guest is Bob Campbell, the author of The Golden Years of Broadcasting, a celebration of the first 50 years of radio and TV on NBC. We were listening earlier to an excerpt from the opening of the Hollywood studios, and Hollywood became an important focal point for the dissemination of radio broadcasting, I would assume. Did you go out there at all? Did you have to?
Oh, yes. I felt if I didn't go to Burbank and spend some time there and look around, it would have been an incredible mistake, because, you know, depending on which side of the country you're on, you have different definitions of which is the dog and which is the tail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, particularly today, yes.
And Burbank is, the major source of programming.
Well, of course, it probably was even in the 40s, wasn't
sure,
it?
Sure, because of Hollywood.
Sure.
Because all Groucho would never come east, I don't think, for radio or television. In fact, they used to film his old shows and fly them east.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of other people that, you know, wouldn't leave Hollywood because... So that was really the major source of talent.
Yeah, it still is today.
And it still is.
Let's talk a little bit about news coverage, because news had its birth, as far as electronic news is concerned, of course, with the NBC network. How soon into the development of radio broadcasting did they realize that news was an important part of it all?
Well, for a long time, I think news was just 15 minutes a day, wasn't very important. They'd have somebody on from Washington talking about economics or something, and they had a few opinion shows, but it was largely a trivial handout affair. I think the thing that really made news was the years just preceding World War II, when everything started getting hot in Europe, and the whole idea of correspondence, radio correspondence, grew up. And then parallel what newspapers had always been doing. But until then, news on radio was kind of trivial, except for elections, I suppose, was, mm-hmm. was always a major thing. But well, news as we know it was took World War II to pull that out.
Were they beginning to feel the influence of the other networks as far as competition goes in the 30s? Did you find that?
They had the
whole apple, the whole pie.
NBC
themselves.
Had the whole pie until Paley's raid.
Right. 1949.
Yes, Paley's raid. That made CBS, I think. I'm not totally sure. They certainly made a lot of CBS. Because Paley, like a good Pied Piper, took away NBC's Sunday night.
And they did that, and they did it rather effectively,
yes,
too.
Yes, almost totally.
Let's talk about their coverage of sports. They realized early on that this was going to be a major facet of radio and television broadcasting.
Right. Well, sports... you know, sports certainly was big on radio. The Rose Bowl game, the major fights, you know, Lewis and Spalding and mm-hmm. so forth and so on. And then it became just sensational on television. You got the seat on the 50-yard line.
Sure.
And it moves
sure.
up and down, you know.
Right.
In fact, I was in Yankee Stadium in 1947 when Joe DiMaggio hit a surefire home run ball into the left field bullpen, except that Al Gianfrido caught it.
That's right.
Remember
mm-hmm.
that? Well, a couple of years ago, I have two sons. They're 14 and 15. They've been wearing me out to go to Yankee Stadium. I hadn't been there since that particular day. So finally I said, okay, we'll go for bat day. And we went to the stadium. And I couldn't follow a baseball game. I literally, you know, bang, it would be gone. I couldn't, I was just completely spoiled. They never asked to go back.
Wondering where the commentary was.
You have to do it yourself.
Yes. I'd forgotten how to do it.
Well, Graham McNamee certainly is a name to be reckoned with in the early sports. He was in NBC,
sure.
And he was really the first big-time announcer in that area, wasn't he?
Television today offers so much in the way of Christmas entertainment. You can see it night after night if you, especially if you have children, because that's all they'll watch. But in its day, radio also had a special brand of Christmas entertainment, didn't it?
Yes, Dick. In fact, we are going to play one tonight because we're so near to Christmas, and that's Fred Allen's famous story about Santa Claus going on strike, before it became so popular with the rest of the country. And this was a Christmas classic, and I'm sure that those of us remember it, listen to it every year without fail. It was really one of the great shows.
Tonight, old Santa shows his claws in a modern tale called Santa Claus Goes on Strike, or Jingle Bells Shall Not Ring Tonight. Music, maestro.
Special announcement. Santa Claus will not ride this Christmas. In a terse bulletin issued from his North Pole igloo today, Santa says, quote, "I am on a sit-down strike. I refuse to ride this Christmas," unquote. Rumors flood the country.
A report from Miami, Florida says, 200 families stop building chimneys on their cabanas. Do not expect Santa Claus. At Rutland, Vermont, a little girl says,
"I wrote Santa Claus a letter airmail and got no answer. He ain't coming."
At Detroit, Michigan, a labor official says,
"Santa Claus better ride, or the Teamsters Union will pull out every reindeer from here to Nome, Alaska."
At Madison Square Garden, New York City, school children hold monster mass meeting. Tiny spokesman says,
"Santa Claus can't let us down. 200,000 American children have appointed me their spokesman. I'm off to see Santa Claus now. James, my jet scooter."
Well, come in, little boy. What are you doing way up here at the North Pole?
Is this Santa Claus igloo?
Yes, Sonny, I'm Mrs. Claus. Who are you?
I'm Buddy Jones.
Are you lost, Sonny?
No. I'm here to see why Santa Claus refuses to ride this year.
I'm glad you come, son. I've been arguing with the old thumpet all week, and he refuses to budge.
Where is Santa Claus? Claus now, Mrs. Claus?
He's in the next room there, tuning his reindeer bells and sulking.
Can I see Santa?
Twan't do you no good, son, but I'll get him for you. Hey, Santa!
I ain't no use in coaxing, Ma. I ain't a-going.
Come on out, stupid. You got company.
Who?
I'm Buddy Jones, Santa Claus.
Well, don't mean nothing to me, small fry.
Is this awful rumor true, Santa Claus?
Yep, I ain't riding, son.
But this is Christmas Eve, Santa. Trees are lighted. Millions of trusting children have hung up their stockings. The world is waiting for you.
Well, the world can wait. I ain't a-riding.
But Santa...
Hey, no use, Nipper. He's stubborn.
No, I ain't not neither stubborn. Now, my boy. I'm just sick of being Santa Claus. The world don't appreciate nothing. Squabbling, striking, spying, warring.
But you can't quit, Santa. You must have a reason.
Oh, got plenty of reasons, Sprout.
As spokesman for 200,000 kiddies, I demand a statement.
What is it you want to know, Shaver?
Why won't you ride tonight, Santa Claus?
Well, sonny, I'll tell you. Come here, sit down here on my lap. Son, I've been Santa Clausing it ever since the world began. For 1948 years, I've been bringing people presents every Christmas or trying to spread joy. My intentions has been good, but my reward has been nothing but heartaches and misery. The first trouble I had was way back in ancient Rome. It was Christmas Eve in the court of Nero. The emperor was playing a violin concerto.
Give Nero the peasants.
We want a hearty Estonius. Your Majesty is courteous.
Courteous, you rebel. Scoff at my pizzicato.
Your music will never get Rome heartiest.
Yeah, Nero, you're a Nicky. Get heartiest.
You dog. Be gone, hypocrite. Scram you.
Yeah. Ah, your father's toga.
What tumbles out of me chimney?
Merry Christmas, Nero. Merry Christmas.
Who art thou, Lumpkin, the chimney sweep?
I'm Santa Claus, Nero, bearing Christmas gifts for your majesty.
Ultimus Nauseum, what is it? Another basket of figs from the Rome Kiwanis Club?
Gift is a trinket rare, Nero. So rare it hasn't even been invented yet. Here.
Gramercy, loud. What is this tiny golden box?
It's a cigarette lighter, Nero. Turn that little wheel.
God's blood, it's flames.
Merry Christmas, Nero.
It's flames. Rome has scoffed at Nero. Nero will have his revenge.
Hey, watch that lighter, Nero. You're setting fire to them draperies.
I can't make Rome hot with my music, eh? I'll make Rome hot another way. Revenge.
Look
revenge.
Out, Nero. Fire, fire.
So you see, son, if it wasn't for Santa Claus, Rome wouldn't have burned that time.
Gosh, that was too bad, Santa.
See, there I was trying to spread good cheer, and what did I get? The first hot foot in history.
But that was 2,000 years ago, Santa Claus. You shouldn't hold a grudge that long.
Well, Nero was just a prologue to my trouble, son. A few centuries later, I set out to bring a present to Napoleon and Josephine. I'll never forget that Christmas, son. Josephine was sitting on her cheesy davenport. Napoleon opened the door.
Oh, Lucy, my petite.
Oh, Natty.
Oh, voila. I am detour on the way to Waterloo, especially to say au revoir.
Oh, mon lover, mon nappy weppy.
Sir, maman, turn your nappy is away. C'est la guerre.
I will be faithful.
Bien. If quelqu'un man dare to pay court to my Josephine, I will kill him. Touché.
Your petite Josephine has no other boyfriend, nappy. You swear.
Eh bien. Mon big beefy one.
Nappy, Dorothy, I have a farewell present for you. I will it fetch you with you, see.
Eh bien. Oh, mademoiselle, from any place far.
Who goes there? Who is coming through the fireplace?
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Sacré bleu. You have come to woo my Josephine, gigolo wolf.
Hold on. Put down that truncheon.
Ah, voilà, cochon. And this. Oh. And this. And this.
Oh.
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 And this.
Oh. Help me out.
Hey. Get riddance.
Voilà, your little Josephine returns, Nappy.
Oh, with the mistletoe, you sly pussycat.
Oui. Oh, I forgot it is Christmas Eve. What can be keeping Santa Claus?
Mon Dieu. You are expecting the chap in the red suit?
Oui, Nappy. Don't you think Santa Claus will come?
Not tonight, Josephine.
Yes. Yes, sonny. Napoleon gave me a concussion that Christmas. Running out of the castle, I fell in a moat. My ermine got wet and come to life. My collar and one cuff got away.
You can't stay mad at the world because years ago one crazy Frenchman mussed you up, Santa Claus.
Well, things has happened since, sonny. Another Christmas, I got a raw deal in a suburb of England. It was called the American Colonies. I dropped in at the house of a jockey named Paul Revere. Well, the cottage had no chimney, so I peeked in at the window. Mrs. Revere was carving a Christmas turkey. Paul come a-gimping into the room.
Christmas dinner ready, Effie?
Yes, Paul. Pull up a chair.
No, no. Oop, no. Set my plate on the mantelpiece.
Can't you set down yet, Paul Revere? That ride was last April.
Through every Middlesex village and farm ain't once around Central Park, Effie.
Well, you ought to try and set down for Christmas, Paul. It'll be a nice present for your spy.
Who's that?
Might be a British spy, Paul.
Hand me my gun, Effie. Who's there? Whig or Tory?
Merry Christmas, Paul Revere. It's me, Santa Claus.
So what?
I've got your Christmas present, Paul. It's a cushion stuffed with fuzz from Delaware peaches.
For me to set on?
You bet.
Don't let him in.
I ain't sat down for 8 months, Effie. That buzz sounds mighty tempting.
Might be some enemy trick, Paul.
No, I'm Santa Claus. Honest Injun, Mrs. Revere. Open up.
I got my gun, Effie. I'll open the door a crack.
Merry
Paul, look at his suit.
A red coat. Take this.
Well, son, when I got back to my sleigh and sat down, I was mighty glad I still had that cushion full of Delaware peach fuzz. You see, son, the world's given old Santa plenty of trouble.
Gee, Santa, you've certainly had a lot of trouble.
Well, that's why my spirit's broken, sonny. You see, being Santa Claus is just a pain in one century after the other. I'm giving the world back to Rand and McNally. I'm sure.
Oh, please don't say that, Santa. Have pity on us kids. We'll have no toys.
No, Santa ain't a-moving, son. This is one Christmas I'm going to enjoy in peace. What's that clock striking?
It's 12 o'clock.
Midnight, eh? Well...
It's Christmas Day, Santa Claus.
It don't mean nothing to me. I'm taking it easy. I'm staying right here.
Won't you change your mind, Santa?
I ain't getting kicked around again this Christmas.
Please, Santa Claus.
Oh, shucks. Hush your crying, son. Hey, Ma.
Yes, Santa?
Where's my mittens, my bag, my reindeer, my sleigh?
Santa, you ain't a-going.
Yep, I'm a-going, Ma.
Honest Santa Claus?
Yep, son, I changed my mind.
Oh, thank you, Santa.
Christmas ain't Christmas without Santa Claus. I'm giving the world one more chance.
Can I have a statement for all the kiddies, Santa?
You bet you can, sonny. Just say, it's Merry Christmas. Hi, old Dunder. Hi, old Blitzen.
The Christmas classic of Fred Allen And Santa Claus goes on strike, taking us back many years. We'll get back to our guest, Bob Campbell, the author of The Golden Years of Broadcasting, a celebration of the first 50 years of radio and TV on NBC, in just a moment.
Now you can do your banking any time of the day or night, 7 days a week, with Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank's new 24-hour teller. Just stop into the main office of Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank at Main and College Street in Middletown and apply for your free F&M card. F as in four, M as in money. F&M, for money card. That's all you need to operate the 24-hour teller. Then you can cash a check anytime, withdraw money from your savings account, make mortgage or loan payments, deposit to your personal checking or savings account, and transfer funds from one account to another with your F&M card and the 24-hour teller. Located only at the main office of Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank at Main and College Street in Middletown. Stop in, ask for a demonstration, and for your free card. Now at Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank, Main and College Street in Middletown only. All five branch offices of Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division are open Saturday, 9 to noon. Members, FDIC. Here again, Dick Bertel.
Well, Bob, before we say goodbye to you, I do want to talk about some of those letters. You did go through the letter file, didn't you?
Yes. NBC has its own Dear Abby, you know, and they get several hundred thousand letters a year. And I went through a whole pile of them for about 5 years, and they're marvelous. They tell you a lot about the different lobbies out there.
Sure. And people's biases.
Yes.
And their favorites on television and radio. I love this letter. I just wanted you to know how wonderful I think your newsmen are. I love Jim Hartz. I love Chuck Scarborough. I adore John Chancellor. I think they're simply superfluous.
I read that to John Chancellor. He broke up.
I like this one. In Search of Ancient Astronauts did not convince me that the prehistoric Earth was visited by spacemen, but it did make me wonder whether intelligent life exists at NBC. Well, at any rate, you can read more for yourself in these. Do you have a favorite by any chance?
Well, there's one complaint from a sports fan. It says, tell me, does NBC stand for nobody cares?
I'm sure that's not the case. At any rate, Bob Campbell, thank you so much for being our guest and sharing some of the wonderful contents of your new book, The Golden Years of Broadcasting, with us here on The Golden Age of Broadcasting today. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel.
This is Ed Corcoran.
Good afternoon.
Hang around the brings you the bright side of life that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town. To hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing it yourself.
Al Kemp on the air for Griffin.
It's time to shine.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanic Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends, serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Schirago and Dick Bertel.
Century!
Don't touch that dial. Listen to...
Kraft Foods Company presents Willard Waterman as the Great Gildersleeve.
Texaco service stations and dealers in all our 48 states present for your entertainment Eddie Duchin and his music. Graham McNamee. And Edwin the Fire Chief.